I'm especially thankful to be here today, although I may not be setting the best example for you. I have been struggling the last couple of days with a cold, and I would urge you to stay home if you don't feel good. But sometimes I have to do what I have to do, so here I am. But this morning in particular, not only were my warp engines down, but my impulse drive is only about 50%. So thankfully, we're able to... I felt better as the morning continued, so I'm glad to be here with you again today. It's kind of a wrap-up day. You know, during the last week, we've reviewed many lessons, and Mr. Miller reviewed them with us in his message just a few minutes ago. A number of things we've been reminded of, and that's the one of the interesting aspects of the Holy Days is that, for the most part, we are familiar with them and with the lessons. If we've been through the cycle even a couple of times, we're learning what they are all about, but there's always more to learn. There's always more to emphasize and to review that really does have a place in our lives. So I appreciate the quick review and the reminder that we can make use of those lessons as we continue. But given that today, this weekly Sabbath, falls immediately after the seventh day of unleavened bread, we have an opportunity to, in a sense, to extend that period of time where we're focusing on the lessons that we learn from the spring holy day season. And I want to spend some time on one more aspect that we can emphasize and consider as we continue to move ahead in time. We'll begin in John chapter 13. John chapter 13, verse 5. John chapter 13, verse 5. It says that after that is after Jesus and the disciples were actually during their meal, and after Jesus had stood up and taken a towel and laid aside his outer garments, it says in the previous verse, that after he had done that, he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Now, we follow Jesus' example as we observe the Passover. And we might want to think back and consider that this was the very first part of our observance of these spring holy days. It was the very first thing that we did. It was before we took the bread that represents the broken body of Jesus. It was before we took the wine that represents his shed blood. It was before we were required to have the leavening removed from our homes as we prepared for the period of unleavened bread. It was the very first thing that took place. Now, a lot has happened. We've experienced 9 days since then. And a lot of other lessons have been emphasized, but let's not forget how we started this period and this observance. Drop down to verse 12. Jesus said, when he had finished washing their feet, he took his garments and he sat down again and he said, do you know what just happened? Do you know what I've done to you? He said, you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Now we realize the symbolism that Jesus Christ was presenting, the general terms that he was using of learning to follow his example, but in a practical sense, in a day-to-day application, what does this foot washing mean to us? What lessons can we learn? And how will those lessons carry over into the rest of our lives? The title I've given to the sermon this afternoon is A Foot Washing Heart. Now, I wish that I was more creative, and I wish I was a cartoonist. My father and one of my brothers are just excellent at drawing caricatures, excellent cartoonists. I wish I had that talent and a more creative mind, because I think that the mixed metaphor there, a foot washing heart, could lend itself to some interesting illustrations. What is a foot washing heart? How do we follow Jesus' example and his command that we are to do to or for one another as he has done for us? Now, you may not give a lot of thought to your feet. Unless or until we have trouble, we generally don't pay much attention to our feet. Of course, if you've had any problems, then you pay a lot of attention. Over the years, I've had a couple of different times some painful conditions that affected my feet, and it made them very much an immediate part of my daily concerns. But until they hurt, you just usually don't give them much thought. But when you do consider it for a moment, you realize quickly how important your feet are to you. Your feet have a combined total of 50 bones. More than one quarter of all the bones in your body are in your feet. Your feet have 60 joints and some 200 muscles and tendons and ligaments that hold them together and that allow your feet to bend and to move the way they need to support your weight. Our bodies are amazingly complex. And whenever you stop to do any kind of consideration of how we're put together, it's incredible, beyond our ability really to understand or appreciate. Remember the old gospel song? It's based on Ezekiel 37, called Dem Dry Bones. The toe bone. No, don't start singing this, Mr. Gable. The toe bone's connected to the foot bone connected to the heel bone connected to the ankle bone. Well, you know, it turns out that that's pretty much true. You have a connective tissue that begins at the sole of your feet, of each foot. And through a series of tissues and tendons, it runs the entire vertical length of your body. And it emerges at the base of your skull, and from there to your eyebrow ridge. So think about it. Your big toe is connected to your eyebrows. Now, just walking around every day and dealing with life, your feet deal with hundreds of tons of force each step you take. I've got this new Fitbit thing. It's an activity tracker. It's supposed to keep track of how many steps I take. I'm a little suspicious of it. I haven't had it for very long. I don't think it's very accurate. When I get up in the morning, it's supposed to reset each night at midnight. So when I get up in the morning and pad out to the kitchen to make my coffee, I checked it this morning and it said it was 450 feet. I'd taken 450 steps. To get from my bedroom to the kitchen. Our house is not that big. But that's okay. If it wants to be generous to give me credit for more steps than I've actually taken, then that's all right. But because I'm supposed to take 10,000 steps a day to just maintain good health, to be active to that degree. I can do that if I go to Planet Fitness and spend an hour on the treadmill, but that's about the only way it's going to get done. But your point is, your feet carry you wherever you go. Your feet are the foundation of your body. And when they're working right, they give you stability, and you can stand, and you can maintain your balance, and you can walk, and you can run, and you can jump. Well, maybe some of us don't jump so much anymore. but it enables us to get around safely. The concentration of nerve endings in the sole of your foot is also amazing. There's so many nerves that end in the bottom of your foot, and that's why your foot is so sensitive and why you're ticklish on the bottom of your foot. In fact, whipping the bare sole of a foot has been used in some cultures as a punishment, a way of punishing or even torturing someone. We have a granddaughter who's 8 years old, loves to be tickled, but do not touch the bottom of her feet. It's too intense. It's too much, and it doesn't just tickle, it actually hurts. So our feet are very sensitive, and they take a lot of abuse or a lot of use every day, and they're certainly a very important part of our life continually. In Bible times, walking was the primary mode of transportation. Now, maybe sometimes there was a donkey or a cart involved, but for the most part, people walked to get from one place to another. Look at just a kind of an aside type reference, John chapter 7, verse 1. John chapter 7, verse 1. You'll find throughout the Gospels that there were times when Jesus and the disciples talked things over as they were walking from one location to another. Here it says in John 7, verse 1, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. He didn't want to walk in Judea because the Jews there were seeking to kill him. He spent his time up north until the final months of his life because it was dangerous for him to be down in the southern area around Judea. And they traveled from one area to the other by walking. And you find a kind of an interesting path, so to speak, through the Gospels of the last journey that Jesus and his disciples took. And it kind of documents their travel as they were walking from Galilee down to Jerusalem as they came to observe that final Passover. So, in these times when people walked to get from one place to another, the most common footwear was a sandal. People didn't have Nikes, they didn't have hiking boots, they didn't have New Balance walking shoes. They mostly just wore sandals, and so their feet took quite a beating. So it's not surprising that people in that time, in that culture, paid more attention to their feet. Let's go back way before Jesus' time and look at a couple of quick examples. In Genesis 18, Genesis chapter 18, we see the beginning here of something that we'll notice is mentioned really a few times in Scripture. Genesis 18, verse 1. This is about when Jesus, as a man, along with two angels, appeared to Abraham prior to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis 18, verse 1, it says, "The Lord appeared to him, that is to Abraham, by the terebinth trees of Mamre. He was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and he looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them, and he bowed himself to the ground. And he said, 'My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant.'" So Abraham recognized that these were not just three guys walking by. He recognized these were special guests, special visitors. And they kind of arrived in a way that was startling as well. They just kind of suddenly were there. He was pleased to see them. He welcomed them. He wanted them to stay and to visit. He says, "Please, let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree." It was the hot time of the day. And so Abraham offered them some water to wash their feet so they could be refreshed. On a hot day, have you ever, maybe when you were younger anyway, taken a garden hose and just kind of run water over your feet on a hot summer day? It's pretty refreshing, isn't it? Or maybe sit by the side of a lake on a dock or the side of a swimming pool and just dangle your feet into the water. It's refreshing. It's because all those nerve endings are down there and they're all worked up on a hot day, and it just feels good. It's comforting. It's relaxing. It's one of those times when we do notice our feet. And so to refresh folks in this culture at this time, often they were offered some water to rinse their feet. As they've been walking in those sandals and they're all dusty and hot, and it just feels good to rinse your feet off. In chapter 19, we find the two angels that had been there in that occasion with Abraham. They've gone on now to Sodom. And we see in verse 1 of Genesis 19, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate. When Lot saw them, he arose, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground, and he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night. Wash your feet, and then rise early and be on your way." This, again, was kind of a cultural thing. The leaders of the city would sit at the gate, and as people would come who were strangers, they would often offer them a place to spend the night so that they could be refreshed and be safe, have a meal, and then continue on their journey. It was a matter of courtesy, a showing concern for a stranger and welcoming them, providing them with, among other things, some fresh water, again, to wash their feet, to offer them comfort. We see another example in chapter 24, Genesis 24, verse 31. We're breaking into the story here where Abraham's servant had been sent to find a wife for Isaac. And I think you probably know the story. It's pretty easily understood here. If you read through this chapter, we're going to break in here again to the middle here where the servant arrives. Verse 31. Laban actually says to the servant, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord." It's polite, respectful greeting. Recognize him most likely as one from their family line. And he welcomed him. He said, why are you standing outside? I've prepared the house and a place for your camels." So the man came in the house, he unloaded the camels, and he provided straw and feed for the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of his men who were with him. So we see in all three of these examples the same theme, that offering water to refresh someone after who's been in a hot, dusty journey was a courtesy to provide for them the comfort that they would need, to take and show care and concern for them. Now let's look at another example, a little further into, the more time has passed up to David's time. We're up to about 1000 B.C. when David became king. So this is slightly before that. We'll pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 23. 1 Samuel chapter 23. This is an event that took place during the time that David was on the run from Saul. And he was an outcast. Saul was still king. Saul was aware that David was ultimately going to replace him, and Saul was trying to do harm to David. Would have killed him if he'd had the opportunity. So David is on the run from Saul. You see in verse 14 of chapter 23 that David was in a wilderness called Ziph, which is south of Jerusalem, about 40 miles along the shore of the Dead Sea. The people there tried to deliver David into Saul's hands, but David had moved further away, so Saul was not able to find him, as you continue on through this chapter. At the end of the chapter here, about verse 24 or so, we see where David would have had an opportunity to do harm to Saul if he'd chosen to, But he passed up that opportunity out of respect for him and didn't take advantage of that situation. Then we come to chapter 25. Chapter 25 begins a new part of this story where David is on the run. There was there in this area, it says Samuel had died in verse 1. Verse 3, while David was in the wilderness of Paran, there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. He was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was a good and understanding, she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his doings. David has a little encounter here with Nabal, and it's not a very pleasant one. He did more than just take David's parking spot, but he made a real nuisance of himself in the way that he dealt with David and his men. You see, they were on the run, and they basically relied on the people that they, in the villages around them and the people in the area, to provide them with what they needed for their food. And David sent his servants to ask Nabal to help them out, to take care of them, provide for some of their needs. They pointed out as they approached him that they had not harmed the shepherds. They had not done anything that was malicious or damaging to anyone. They just were there, but they needed some help. Nabal answered David's servants, and he said, "Who is this David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away from their master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my food that I've killed for my people and give it to the men that I don't know?" He was pretty rude, pretty thoughtless, and just not very concerned about David's needs. So he sent him away, and David was angry at that. It says in verse 12, David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him the words, and David said to his men, "We're going to get that guy. That parking spot is ours. Strap on your swords." He took 400 men. Now, Nabal, all by himself with a few shepherds and some guys cutting the wool. And David takes 400 warriors, and he's on his way to take care of this jerk. He's such a scoundrel, it describes him in verse 17. Now, one of the young men, who was one of Nabal's servants, told Abigail what was happening. He told her, "Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness," we're in verse 14, "to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men have been very good to us. We were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as they were here. We accompanied them. They were a wall to us, both by night and day. In fact, see, they provided protection and help for these shepherds. Now, therefore, no one consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household. For he, Nabal, is such a scoundrel that no one can speak to him." He's such an unpleasant and evil man that his own servants were afraid of him, and they couldn't approach him to try to talk some sense into him. So Abigail did something that was very admirable. She'd made haste. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, just happened to have this in her pantry, loaded them up on donkeys, and she sent her servant on ahead but she says she didn't tell her husband Nabal. So it was, she rode on the donkey and went down over the hill. and there were David and his men coming down toward her. She met them. Now, she must have been one courageous woman. Here come 400 angry men, hungry, angry men. And they had one thing on their mind, and that was to dispatch Nabal. But she went down and she met them. David said, "Surely in vain I have protected all this fellow has in the wilderness. Nothing was missed of all that belongs to him. And here's how he repays me: evil for good. May God do so and more to the enemies of David if I leave one male of those of his household by morning light." Abigail dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed down before him on the ground. She said, "O my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him." Look it up, the word Nabal means fool. And good example of someone who was like what his name meant. So she presented herself to him, begged David for his patience, and to take the gifts that she was offering to them, and that's really all that David was asking for in the first place. In fact, she undoubtedly brought more than what he had sent his men to get and more than he would have expected. And he said, "Do not avenge yourself with your own hand. Let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal." Verse 27, "This present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow you. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant." She took his mistakes on herself. And she said, if you're going to do anybody in, let it be me. Let me take the blame. And she sought his mercy. "For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord," speaking to David, "fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." Appealing to the good side of David's nature. He could get pretty angry, apparently. But she was remembering and reminding him that this was beneath him. He didn't need to behave like this. This was something he could leave in God's hands. "Yet a man," verse 29, "has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord, of you, David, shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, and the lives of your enemies he will sling out." She reminded him that God would be the one who would take care of the situation. Verse 31, "Let this not be grief to you nor an offense to the heart of my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause or that my Lord has avenged himself. But that when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant." So she was very humble, very respectful, offered herself in place of her husband, and offered the food and the sustenance which David and his men needed. This calmed him down. David said to Abigail, "Blessed is the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, surely by morning, no males would have been left to Nabal." He was certainly had the power, the authority, the resources to destroy that entire household. Now, it turns out that very soon after that, Nabal died at the hand of God. lead down to verse 36. Nabal was merry and he was drunk. And so it was in the morning when the wine had gone from Nabal that Abigail told him what she had done, what had happened, how she had saved him. And his heart died within him and he became like a stone. And after 10 days, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Nabal ultimately died at the hand of God. Now when David learned of that, he must have been even more humbled that Abigail had prevented him from harming Nabal because God had taken care of the situation. He was so impressed that he proposed to Abigail. Verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and kept his servant from the evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head." And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. He was so impressed that he wanted to take Abigail to be his wife. Now, brings up a few other questions that maybe we can deal with some other time. We can talk about the family structure in the Old Testament and multiple wives and some of the things on that order. Maybe that's another topic. For now, we just want to consider the actions here of Abigail and how God used her to protect David from himself. We see a lot of qualities in this woman. We see courage. We see a willingness to lay down her life for the sake of her evil husband. We see that she was a capable woman who knew how to take action, knew how to put together the provisions that this group of men would need, had her own household organized and structured, and people were responsive to her as she organized the effort. She had concern for David and his men and knew that they needed these provisions and appreciated that they had not done any harm to Nabal or to any of their possessions. And she took action. She was a woman who was willing and courageous enough to do something when that was necessary. And as a result, David is so impressed that he wants to take her to be his wife. Verse 41, "She arose and bowed her face to the earth, and she said, 'Here is your maidservant.'" She is responding to his proposal. "Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." She was given the opportunity of a lifetime to become a bride of the one who would be the next king over the land. And she had a foot-washing heart. Among all the other qualities that she exhibited, she exhibits humility by her willingness to be a servant to his servants, to wash the feet of the other servants. Now, this is the first time I can find in Scripture a reference to a person washing another person's feet. Up to this time, we see several references to washing of feet, and people wash their own feet. It's refreshing, it's comforting, it's good, it's helpful to them, but they take care of their own feet. She is offering to wash the feet of those who are his servants. It's a remarkable attitude or heart that she displayed. Let's consider another example in Jesus' time. In Luke chapter 7, Luke the 7th chapter, we read yesterday in a different message about Jesus' encounter with one of the Pharisees when he was having a meal with him. This is another occasion. It happened actually before the one we talked about yesterday. Luke chapter 7, we find that in verse 36, one of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and he sat down to eat. Now, it's a little hard, perhaps, to picture the setting here as we get into some of the details. But this was a meal that was sponsored by one of the Pharisees. It was apparently in a kind of an open setting, probably accommodating a large group of people. It wasn't just a small gathering at his home. He may have had a large home with a large courtyard area, but a lot of people had gathered there for the meal. And it was, according to the expositor's commentary, it was a custom of the time to permit needy people to kind of be around the fringe of this kind of a banquet so they could receive some of the leftovers. They could benefit from some of the food that wasn't eaten by the actual guests of the banquet. Now, Jesus was reclined at a low table with his feet kind of out to the side rather than being under the table the way we might sit on a chair. They were on the ground at a low table with his feet extended out to the side. Verse 37. Behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table at the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil. And she stood at his feet behind him, weeping, and she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with fragrant oil. The woman is described as a sinner. Now, some have concluded, in some commentaries, they come to the conclusion that she must have been a prostitute and was probably someone well known in the area for that, had that reputation. But really, all it says in this account is that she was a sinner. It doesn't say that that was what she was guilty of. And, of course, in the eyes of the Pharisee, she was an unwashed, unclean Gentile woman. Of course, he would dismiss her as a sinner. So maybe she was, maybe she wasn't a prostitute. That's not really important. But the point is that the Pharisee looked down on her. And from his perspective, even being touched by this woman would be just a terrible thing. It would leave him ceremonially unclean to have this woman come anywhere near him. But she came to Jesus and she had this alabaster jar. An alabaster jar was a container that was used for valuable substances such as perfume. It wasn't necessarily very big. It was more like a vial, most likely. But it had kind of a long, kind of a bell bottom, and had a long neck at the top. They would break the neck off to pour out the contents. That was the kind of bottle that she, or jar, or vial that she had. The word alabaster refers to the kind of minerals it was made from. Other translations just call it a vessel that was made of valuable stone. So this was something that was very valuable. And as this woman came to him, it probably meant a lot to her. It was something that was not easy for her to come by. It was something that she was giving up for him out of respect to him. She had come prepared to anoint his feet as an act of courtesy, kindness, and comfort, and a deep respect. And she became so emotionally moved by doing so that she cried so much that her tears dampened his feet. Now, she'd come with an alabaster jar prepared to anoint his feet, but she probably hadn't planned on it being so. It's just an emotional moment for her. So she didn't have a towel. So she kneeled over and dried his feet with her hair. It was an impulsive act of worship, respect, tenderness, and love. By anointing his feet with this perfume, she was also offering a greater level of comfort. This was not done out of necessity. She didn't see, oh, this poor guy has dirty feet, let's go clean them. It was done to show the courtesy, respect, concern, the thoughtfulness, and to worship him. So the Pharisee was nasty about this. He said, if this man was a prophet, verse 39, he'd know who this woman was who's touching him, for she's a sinner. He was repulsed at the thought of this creature coming up to Jesus and washing his feet in such an emotional situation or show or portrayal. Jesus said, Simon, I got something to ask you. So he asks this question about forgiveness. And we're not going to necessarily read that portion of the story, but obviously the one who is forgiven the most would be the most thankful. And Jesus is making the point that this woman needs me more than you do. And she is deserving of his concern in return for what she had done for him. He said to her in verse 44, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You gave me no water for my feet. See, that was, again, a standard, a custom, a courtesy that any guest would be offered. But this Pharisee was so rude, so disrespectful, that he didn't even extend the common courtesy of some water to refresh and rinse his feet. But she's washed my feet with her tears and dried them with her head, with her hair. You didn't greet me with respect, with a kiss. It's a Middle Eastern thing, a little foreign to us. But you've seen pictures of people in these cultures where they, you know, you get a kiss on each side of the face. Again, it's a courtesy. It's a show of friendliness and respect. Jesus said, you didn't show any courtesy to me at all. Not so much as to rinse my feet or to what we might suggest would be like a warm handshake. But this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Jesus respected and appreciated the heart that this woman showed by the way that she approached him. And by the way, aren't we all thankful that Jesus introduced foot washing, not foot kissing? But it showed her heart. It showed where she was coming from. She had a foot washing heart. We see again some characteristics that this woman had. Her desire to honor Jesus Christ. Her desire to offer him comfort that had been denied by his host. Her willingness to share what was valuable to her with him because he was so special to her. She had the kind of heart that Jesus is looking for in his disciples as he instructed us to wash one another's feet. Back to John again, chapter 13. I want to compare a couple of verses here quickly. John 13, verse 4. I just kind of went by this quickly a few minutes ago. That Jesus rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and wrapped it around himself, as a servant would, who would come to take care of the needs of the guests for the dinner. Excuse me. That's what Jesus did. Now let's compare that to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. Of course, it's always interesting to remember as you read this epistle that this was the man who argued with Jesus Christ about washing his feet. He was at that dinner. He experienced that night along with the other disciples with Jesus Christ. Toward the conclusion of his epistle, he's writing some general instructions. He says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to the elders. to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. As Jesus took on the garments of a servant, Peter reminds us in our relationships to one another to, in effect, set aside our outer garments, take on the towel, and kneel down and care for one another as Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. It's a word picture that I would conclude that Peter must have had in mind as he wrote this epistle. We too then are to clothe ourselves, to wrap ourselves in humility, as Jesus did when he knelt down to wash the feet of his disciples. Peter clearly remembered the teacher, the Lord, the Master, clothing himself in humility as he cared for his disciples. So we see some examples of foot washing, the attitude, the heart that is involved in it, the reason for it even, to provide the comfort and the refreshing that a person would offer as a matter of being respectful. We see the attitude of sacrifice. We see the attitude of worship and of respect for the one whose feet are being washed. And Jesus Christ instructed us to follow his example. So again, how does a foot-washing heart translate into our relationships? How do we portray the attitude that this teaches? Now, we could sit down and talk this over. We could put together a list of 20 or 10 or 5 or 12 or 7 things we should do to show respect. But you know, if it comes from a list, then it's probably not going to come from the heart. I don't know that it's helpful or meaningful for us to be too specific about here's what you do, A, B, C, and D, and then you've got the right heart. I don't think really that's how it works. Instead, I would suggest that each of us think about it for ourselves. What can I do to follow the example of Jesus Christ? How can I treat my brethren so that I'm following the example that Jesus Christ gave? I would say there are many excellent examples in our congregations of people who do just that. Those who are the first to step forward to offer help to their brethren. Those who are consistent in doing so over time. It's not just a one-time situation. They continually step forward to help. It's important for all of us to see that what Jesus Christ is looking for in us is the understanding that we honor and respect and comfort one another. He told the disciples he didn't have to wash their feet because they were dirty, but it was because he wanted them to learn from his example. We learn from his example. We learn from the example of Abigail. We learn from the example of this woman in Luke chapter 7 of what it means to wash someone's feet. You do it once a year at Passover, and that's probably all we need to do as far as actually literally washing another person's feet. But do you live that way, following the example that Jesus set for us? I think the symbol is very important. The symbol of actually having the foot washing service is that graphic reminder that this is something that Jesus literally did. And we literally can do it as well as we remember that hymn at the Passover service. But more importantly, we practice it the rest of the year. John 13, verse 34, another verse in this same chapter. Again, one that we're familiar with, where Jesus elaborated on what he expects us or of us. John 13, verse 34. He says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Now, the word new doesn't mean that it didn't exist before. We like things that are new. We like stuff that no one ever owned, that has just been built or created, and it's ours. It's brand new. It didn't exist before. But that's not what this is. The word new that's used here comes from a Greek word that means to refresh or to renew. It's a commandment or an instruction that's been given before, but one that Jesus is adding a new dimension to. It's much like the way he introduced certain principles in Matthew 5. You've heard it said of old, but I say unto you, where he's adding to the requirement. So that's the new instruction I give to you, and that is that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. How did Jesus love you? Again, I think that might be something for you to think about, to meditate on, to pray about. How did Jesus love you? How often have we benefited from his patience, his mercy, his gentleness, his guidance? How much does Jesus Christ mean to each of us? You all have unique experiences. You can think about things in your life that are special to you, where you can see his hand caring for you, guiding you, protecting you, encouraging you, strengthening you. You can see those things in how Jesus Christ has loved you. And what he's telling us then, take that love that I've shown to you and share it with one another. Have that kind of a heart, the foot-washing heart that Jesus Christ himself portrayed. Essentially, what it comes down to is that his love for us was expressed by putting us first. He put us first. We won't go back to Philippians chapter 2. I'm sure you can recall it, familiar. Read it again yourself, beginning in verse 5, where it describes how that Jesus, when he was God, set that aside to come down here with us and to serve us as he did. Sometimes that's too big for us to really appreciate. But we can try to wrap our minds around what it means for God to become man to the point of death for his own creation. He gave up being God because he put us first. Now, there was a path, certainly, that he was going to follow that would allow him then to be restored to his glory. But he set that aside so that he could become the way by which we can receive what he has. We can share his inheritance. John chapter 10, verse 11. John chapter 10, verse 11. Jesus says here, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Now, Jesus literally died for us. We certainly understand that. We know that clearly. But a good shepherd doesn't necessarily die for his flock. What good would that do? I can protect you from this one wolf, and it's going to eat me, but then I'm gone, and he's going to come after you. What good would it do for a shepherd to literally die for his flock? I mean, again, Jesus did that, but I think there's another point here. He put the needs of the flock ahead of himself. He put his life on the line to care for his flock. Not just one time, continually, constantly, over and over again. He dedicated his life to his flock. See, that's a way in which we can follow that example of Jesus Christ. he put his flock first, and he dedicated himself continually to the care of that flock. That's the way that we can follow his example. John 14 again, verse 13. Okay, John 15, verse 13, I'm sorry. John 15, verse 13. Greater love has no man than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Lay down one's life for his friends. Now, the word lay down has many different uses. The word that's translated from the Greek has many different uses. It can mean literally to die in place of, as Jesus Christ did for us. And I don't want to take anything away from that fact, that he actually did give his life on our behalf. But you see, he was in a position where he could do that, where his life mattered in that way. You can't really die for someone else. You could jump on a hand grenade so that others aren't injured by it, but their life is preserved for some time. It's not really saved. You can have some heroic act that would somehow cause you to lose your life. But I think that this phrase that is being used here means much more than that. To lay down, again, has many different purposes or many different uses. It can mean to die in place of. It can also mean to appoint or to commit or to put in place. To lay something down. You're putting something in place. You're committing, you're appointing something. In other words, to value someone's life more than your own. To care for them and to serve them, to commit yourself to the care of another, is indeed laying down your life for one another. Look at Mark chapter 10. You know, Jesus instructed his disciples, and this is a case where they had had an argument about which of them was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. I think this is the case where James and John's mother came and tried to give them, arrange for them to have a special place in the kingdom. And they got all riled up. And Jesus took that opportunity to teach them what was really important about being in the kingdom. It's not about being great. It's not about being more important than someone else. We drop down to the conclusion of his teaching to them. He said, whoever of you desires to be first should be the slave of all, the servant of all. One of the most basic principles of leadership. If you want to be a leader, if you want to be great, if you want to be someone special, then don't try to make yourself better than others, but serve everyone. Earlier on here, he talks about the Gentiles and how they lord it over those that they have authority over. Jesus said that's not the way that his disciples would be, that his disciples would be known because they would be the slaves or the servants to everyone else. That's the foot washing heart. That's the desire and willingness to serve others, put them ahead of yourself. Years ago in another church area out on the West Coast, I was counseling with a man who was the Lord, the King, the master of his house. And he ruled that household with an iron fist. I mean, he was tough. In fact, he was abusive, both verbally and physically. Came to the point where I was warning him that if this didn't come under control, that I had an obligation to tell law enforcement what was happening in that home. He was ruling or lording it over his family. But he was trying to convince me, and he was, by the way, he came around, and I didn't have to call the police. But during this discussion, he was trying to convince me. He said, he wanted me to know how much he loves his wife and children. He said, I would die for my wife and for my children. I said, well, you know, that's not the question. The question is, will you live for your wife and for your children? Will you be the husband and the father they need? Will you care for them and respect them and honor them? Being in charge of them is not an issue. Being in command is not what's important. Jesus Christ doesn't love us that way. He gave himself for us. Literally laying down your life for someone else could actually be a thoughtless or a selfish act. It could be just a spur-of-the-moment thought or idea and may not have any depth or meaning to it at all. But to live for your life, for your loved ones, to put them ahead of yourself continually and constantly and sincerely, that's laying down your life for your family, for your friends, for your brethren. And we have the opportunity to lay down our lives for one another every day. We have that opportunity to show compassion and care for all of those in the congregation. To be forgiving. Not to be holding matters in our heart that maybe we were angry about at some point. But being willing to overlook those hurts. Ephesians 4 talks about endeavoring to keep the unity of the faith and enduring one another. You know, sometimes we, as we are learning to be a family, we have to put up with each other. We have to be willing to accept the differences. It says, walk with all lowliness and gentleness, verse 2 of Ephesians 4. Lowliness and gentleness, those are the characteristics of a foot-washing heart. Long-suffering, which means patience. That's not really talking about trials. The word that's used there is not talking about continuing or being willing to persevere through your difficulties. It means patience. Patience with each other. To be willing to bear with one another. That literally means to put up with one another. But not begrudgingly, not in a distant way or a kind of a cold way, but to bear with one another in love. To put up with one another with that genuine sense of concern and care for one another. Wanting to comfort, to respect, to care. Endeavoring or working, striving to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Laying down our lives for one another is a pretty complicated thing, but it doesn't have to be. Are we willing to show the respect and the care that Jesus Christ is expecting of us? It represents thoughtfulness, compassion, empathy, courtesy, awareness, willingness to sacrifice of yourself to comfort, to refresh. These are the attitudes we are to learn to share with one another that are represented by the simple foot washing ceremony. James 1, verse 27. James chapter 1, verse 27. Tells us that pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. To be willing to extend ourselves into situations that are not socially comfortable. Now, it's one thing to have our friends and we enjoy being with them and maybe spending time recreational or just relaxing together. And that's fine. We all have our close friendships. But pure religion, pure obedience to this instruction that Jesus Christ has given to us, is to be willing to spend time with others when it's not so fun and easy. The widows and the orphans represent, literally, like they could be widows and orphans, but they also represent those who are in need. Those who are part of our family, our church family, who have needs that we can help to supply. Chapter 2, verse 15. Same book, James 2, verse 15. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to him, depart in peace and be warm and filled, but you do not do the things which are needed for the person, what good does that do? Actually, James is making a different point than I'm making. We should understand that. James is talking about faith. He's talking about how that you can't say you have faith but not have evidence of it. And he uses this as an example. But I think we can take what he puts here, what he's using as an analogy, in a more literal way as well. That when we're in a position to help someone, then they need more than just, oh, God will take care of you. See you next Sabbath. People sometimes need us to practice that pure and undefiled religion of reaching out to help one who's in need. Now, again, I'm not saying that we aren't doing that. I believe that my wife and I always enjoy the friendship, the camaraderie, the obvious concern and compassion and love that people in our congregations have for one another. But I am suggesting that we can continue to grow even in these areas, where we practice on a regular basis, continually, what it means to have a foot-washing heart. Let's read one more verse in John chapter 13. John the 13th chapter, verse 37. We're talking about, this is something that Peter grew in. We know that he went beyond this particular condition. John 13, verse 36, Peter said to Jesus, where are you going? Jesus had said, I'm going someplace where you can't follow. So Peter said, where are you going? And Jesus said, well, where I am going, you can't follow me, but you follow me afterward. And Peter said, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. Now, in this case, Peter literally did mean to die for Jesus, or to die in his place. Peter was saying that he'd be willing to put himself in the place of Jesus. But you know what? He didn't really have that heart yet. Jesus warned him, and he went on later that day to deny. Peter denied Jesus. He hadn't yet developed that foot-washing heart. He didn't yet have the empathy. Didn't yet have the ability to share the feelings of another and to literally put himself in Jesus' place. Although he did want to, it was something that he had not yet grown in, something he had not yet accomplished. We can grow in these areas too. We also can develop the heart that Peter expressed, but he didn't quite yet have. Later he did. Later Peter continued through his ministry to sacrifice his life for God's people. And some of the most, when you read the epistle, especially of 1 Peter, it is among the most encouraging and uplifting of all of the general epistles. The message that Peter gives about enduring trials and about following the example of Jesus Christ and our place in the church, our place in God's family. Peter writes profoundly of service and his service to the church and our service to one another. We can develop that same heart ourselves. A person with that foot-washing heart is compassionate and responsive, is developing the ability to understand and to share the feelings of others, is willing to reach out and do whatever they can to comfort, to encourage, to strengthen. When we have those feelings, then the action will follow, and we'll do the things that a foot-washing heart does. It takes practice. It takes effort. But it becomes easier as we grow in it. Once a year, we wash each other's feet at Passover. It's a reminder that every day we have the opportunity to love one another as Jesus Christ loved us, and to lay down our lives for one another.